Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. With me in studio today is Brian King, a technology leader from the EdTech and facility security industries. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Andrew. It's great to be here.
So I know, like a previous Underserved guest, Mike Bro, you started programming primarily because of your dad?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Back when I was younger, I sometimes joke with my kids that changes in technology were basically when we went from white chalk to colored chalk. I was in elementary school. So there wasn't a lot of access to computers back in the 60s. You know, they were in institutions and government facilities and not yet in people's homes for the most part. But my dad got into it early. He went to college with the GI Bill in San Jose State and then took an aptitude test. And they basically, hey, we think you'd make a good programmer. So it kind of took off for him from there. And he ended up at a variety of companies and moved around. We were living in San Jose at the time, and we moved up to Seattle, Washington, and then back to Santa Monica, and then out to Oakland, New Jersey, eventually to Westford, Massachusetts, and mostly, you know, following along in his career. It was an interesting time. I think of today as like, you want to work on your computer, you just go and pull up your laptop and start working. And back then, these systems were dedicated. So he got time allocated to him, and it might be at 3 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, he'd go off and disappear for a few hours and program basically in microcode, and that was his career. And for me, other than 70s, I mean, he got a TRS-80, which we called the Trash 80, but in high school was the first time we had access to a computer, and we had exactly one PDP-8, you know, it was old Digital Equipment Corporation computer that they had donated to the school, and I think you had mentioned in an earlier podcast that was a big thing at the time, and tech, you know, donated out a lot of equipment around the area. And, you know, this is, again, one of these single-user systems. If the thing ever lost power, you'd basically have to toggle in the bootstrap program, which basically was the driver for the paper tape reader, which you would then use to load the operating system in BASIC, and then you could go off and write your BASIC program. So there was one class that used that, and so I was in that class. And then using the TRS-80, you know, with my dad, you'd find programs in magazines and enter the programs, or we had this. It was one point, it felt like a drug buy or something. We went to this guy's apartment and he had all these boxes lying around them, and they were programs on cassette tapes that you could buy from him, and, you know, way before Staples or any of that stuff where you could buy software or buy it online. And we picked up a couple programs there and got to play around with them. But he was involved in the early Mercury project and work on NORAD as part of what he was doing. And I think the other interesting part about that time, too, is information is so readily at your fingertips these days, thanks to the internet. And back then, it was knowing what you wanted to do with your life and how to find out what the possibilities were was extremely difficult. You know, you'd basically you'd take one of these Army aptitude tests and they'd say, oh, yeah, you'd be a great key punch operator or be great at making horseshoes or something. So the first thing I thought of was like, well, my dad's doing this. He seems to enjoy it. And what I've done with it, it seems kind of fun. So I kind of stumbled into that path, I guess, and then ended up going to Northeastern. And at Northeastern, they had the CDC 6600 mainframe was what we first started programming on. And we were using punch cards at that time. So it was a big advancement from paper tape. And then by the end of my college career, we had AdVaxes. But along the way, I got a co-op position at Digital, which was awesome. It was such an experience. About two and a half years that I worked there. And first, just as a co-op, as Northeastern has that program where you spend pretty much half your time in classes and half your time doing a job that's hopefully related to the thing you'd like to be doing when you graduate, which gives you a great sense of whether it's really something you want to do for the rest of your life. It removes all illusions about what that career path might be like. But at that time, DEC was a great place to work because they were very much into training their employees and bring them up. I mean, they had a whole training center in Bedford at the time, which just had an amazing number of courses that you could take, and certainly took advantage of that and just colleagues there as well. But it also gave me a great opportunity because now I had access to a computer whenever I needed it. And so in terms of getting my homework done and really spending time and working through all the challenges, it was awesome.
Your dad was at NORAD. Did he work on Joshua, the system that was famous in War Games that Matthew Broderick broke into?
You know, I wish I knew more about what he did during that time. It was pretty early on when they were building up NORAD for the first time, and same with the Mercury project. It's like, how are we going to get men into space? How are we going to get men to the moon? So It was pretty cool. And I, unfortunately, and this is one of those things, and anybody younger in the audience is like, talk to your parents while you have the opportunity to do that. Talk to your grandparents while you have the opportunity to do that, because there's going to come someday when you don't have that choice anymore. And you're going to regret not asking those kinds of questions to really get the full color of what they did with their lives. I do genealogy research now as something my dad did. And I learned it. I enjoyed it as well. Just kind of digging into and finding out people in the past. And occasionally you find stories about people, but it's mostly birth and death records and that sort of thing, which is still interesting. But you don't get the depth and the color that you have when you sit down and just have a conversation with somebody. And that's just fascinating.
100% agree. A few years back, I got into checking out Ancestry.com and 23andMe. And I had had many conversations with my mom and my grandmother, but you wish you'd had more. You end up having so many more questions later on.
Yeah, my grandmother had a colorful life, and there was a whole period of time when she lived in Lawrence back in the days when it was a big textile manufacturing town, and her parents were basically off the boat from Ireland and England, and that's where they started, and her mother ended up dying in childbirth after giving birth to twins, and she died, and the children died, and her sister died at the same time.
Jeez.
So there was this whole series of articles going day to day to day that I dug up after going to the library, because that was the only way I could get to that information at the time up in Lawrence. And it was fascinating.
So nowadays, do you try to instill into your kids an interest in technology or?
Yeah, that's a great question. I really wanted my kids to find their passion. If they were interested in technology, I would absolutely support them along that way. And with what I learned, my son Liam is my younger son. Fabulous drummer right now. He's 13 years old. He's in his band. He was in the jazz band in his middle school. The reason he got into drumming was because he's a perpetual motion machine and he would just bang on anything around the house. And this was when he was pretty young, you know, preschool and then early elementary school. And we're like, we got to do something. It's wintertime. He's driving us nuts. So he said, oh, let's get him a drum kit. So we got him one of those toy drum kits that are $20, $30 or something. And he went crazy on it. And then they did a talent show in the school. And so he did that and with somebody else, and he would do jokes with one of his other mates. And then he'd do just a ba-dum-bum on his little toy drum kit. And from there, it just evolved into him getting more into drums. We bought an electronic used one from a friend of ours who was a drummer, professional drummer. And he hooked up with some other friends in the neighborhood who were doing a band, and their dad was a professional musician. And then they started playing together. And it's just evolved since then and getting an acoustic kit. But that's a passion for him. Would I push him to do that as a career? I don't know. I think it's one of those things. Yeah, become a football player, but don't expect to necessarily make a living off of that. But if it's a great avocation that you love to do, that's awesome. But I always tell him, have a plan B, figure out what that's going to be.
I think you were involved in coaching a Lego league as well.
Yeah. So my other son, Daniel, has been more interested in technology and particularly in robotics. So we started up a Lego league team, and me, one of the other dads, and then a couple of the moms in the team. Pulled a team together, several of the kids, you know, friends of my sons, and anybody who's been involved in Lego League knows there's two parts to it. There's a presentation part, and then there's the robotics part. And each year is a different theme, and they set up a bunch of tasks, and there's a mat, and you have to build a robot to execute those tasks. So the Lego Mindstorms robot, they're very cool. So you're building a robot out of Legos, but it's got a computer and it's got different kinds of motors and gears and arms and things like that. But you have to figure out how to design it in order to accomplish those tasks. And at the same time, they're doing research on the particular topic. So it's conservation, trash, that sort of thing, and do a presentation. So it's great in terms of developing confidence, those skills, there's ability to communicate. So the upshot of the whole thing is then you end up going to a competition. So we've been to Worcester a couple of times, and we've been to Northborough school there. But Worcester was neat because it was Worcester Polytech. So that was a big one. Kids are learning how to program. Their whole MO is basically trial and error. Try this. Oh, didn't work. Okay, pull this apart or change this and do something else until it kind of works. And then the programming is very linear. There's no component-based programming. So those are two of the things that I really was trying to push with them is A, think about it in terms of components, that you've got this robot. You're going to be turning right all the time. You're going to be turning left all the time. So make a component that can turn right. Make a component that can turn left. Make a component that can follow a line, you know, and then reuse those things so you don't have this long linear program that has lots of duplication and does things in different ways, because that leads to the second part of this thing, which is robustness. We had the experience where we had our board. It's a big basic 4x8 sheet of plywood with edges on it. And to get this thing working to perfection, and then you'd go to the competition, and it would just fail. Not all the time, but the probability of success was greatly diminished. And you're like, it's a 4x8 piece of plywood. It's got walls that look like the walls that we have. What's going on? You know, is it other electronics in the room? Is it just divots? And, you know, because these aren't, it's plywood, so it's not a flat surface. But it would fail. So it's like your robustness was about, you know, trying it and trying it in different scenarios and making sure it works reliably before you really take it to a competition or put it out there for your customers, the analogy.
That's cool. Well, I think it's an important lesson that you have to test way more than you think you need to.
This evolved into this past summer is like, you know, we're constantly looking for things to do as a project to keep us busy and not driving ourselves up a wall. It was, we built a computer together, my older son and I, something he wanted to do. We needed another computer because we know we were going to be doing virtual learning. So rather than just go buy a laptop from Dell, I said, let's do this. So it's his birthday present. I said, but you know, we're going to do this in a way that you're going to learn something from it. So number one, I'm going to give you a budget. And if you exceed that budget, you know, you can exceed the budget, but then it's on your nickel. So you got to buy the parts. So if you think you got to spend more money for one reason or another, then that's on you. And number two is, as you're figuring out the components that you want to buy that you think you need to explain to me the purpose of those components and why you would choose this model over some other model. And maybe it's a less expensive or maybe it's a more expensive model. And sometimes making the choice between, well, I want to spend more on this piece, but I'm going to spend consequently less on a different part. So we're looking at motherboards, we're looking at chassis, we're looking at fans, we're looking at processors and coolers, all sorts of stuff. The thing that made me laugh is he got the most fun out of was the colors. It's not enough today to just have a computer that is really, really fast, but it's got to be like a light show.
I need the cooling fan with the blue LEDs.
Exactly. But it was great. And he learned a lot about all these different parts. And I hadn't built a computer in a long time. I mean, early in my career, it was like, especially when we started on PCs, is like they weren't just off the shelf. They were always pretty much custom designed. And we would build our own computers. So it was kind of neat going back to that and looking at how the hardware had changed and how it was all pieced together and the scale of things had changed tremendously. It was cool.
So I know due to the way the chips fall and timing, you ended up having the experience of doing a job search during COVID. What's that been like?
Still having the experience. This is not the first time I've gone through that throughout my career. Say about every decade, I've been through a layoff. For a variety of reasons, it's been interesting where I was working on a database system way back in the day and programming on a similar language. And we realized our competitor was Oracle. And at the time, Oracle was a very small company, but it was taking off and we were building a version of a relational database system. And eventually the company got sold and they decided we weren't going to do that so much anymore because they were basically buying the other database product that we had, the company CompuServe, for anybody who's around. Maybe remembers that company, but 1022 was a database behind that and remains on deck 10s and 20s. And then the one we were building ran on VMS. So I got to work on building the join function, which was a learning experience. So that, and then I went off to work for AT&T for a while on an interchange product, which was a proprietary online service for businesses. And it was like 1995, which was basically the time that everybody realized the internet was the way things were going to go. And each time it's a little bit different. And the first time it was traumatizing to me. I was like, oh my God, I failed. This is horrible. And, you know, at some point you start to build up the calluses and realize it's part of business. And each time there was a valid business reason. You know, the company had been sold to Tyco in the era of Dennis Kozlowski and the golden shower curtains and everything else. So they would just buy up a company a day, literally, and just divested of any asset. And we got bought during the tail end of that. You know, there were some downsizing and I was getting frustrated at the time and I actually quit. I talked to my boss about it. And at that point I had young kids or one young kid. And he's like, you really don't want to do this because, you know, you quit and then you don't get severance, you don't get unemployment. But it was the nicest thing he ever did for me because they ended up having a downsize. And he's like, okay, well, he wants to go. So a few months later, he's laid me off. And as a result of that, I got severance for over a year because I had been there for a while at the time. And I was able to look around and see what was available. It was a downtime in the economy, at least as bad as this, probably, if not worse. I mean, you couldn't even get recruiters to call you back. But eventually, I made a connection with somebody I had worked with at the very beginning of my career, who is now working at Pearson. And got me an interview and eventually got me the job. And that really reinforced for me not burning bridges and really maintaining those relationships and those networks because you never really know. And it wasn't like we had stayed in touch and anything, but we remembered each other fondly when she was a tech writer and I was an engineer and then a first-time manager. And then we went off on our different career paths, and she ended up at a vice president at Pearson, got me in. And then I spent the next 10 years there, and it's an awesome experience. And then again, Pearson's been evolving, and you can talk about that a bit, but it's been interesting, the evolution of the online education during the last 10 years, because it's gone from a focus on books, you know, textbooks with software is kind of augmenting that experience, but the revenue is mostly in the textbooks, to textbooks are dying off as a revenue source, and online education is the future, not just education by itself, but as an augmentation to in class with instructors, but supporting that experience as well as being able to just do an online education. So now I'm going through that experience, looking for a job again, and revising my resume and revising my LinkedIn profile. Because every time you go through this, it's like, okay, it's been another 10 years and what a resume looks like has changed completely. And how you express yourself in your profile has changed completely from the way it was 10 years ago. It's about your experience. What did you accomplish? That sort of thing. So I, again, using my network, and I would do a lot of research using LinkedIn and other online job search, mostly using LinkedIn, but a lot of other ones, using that as a jumping board to looking at company websites, because often there'll be more information there than in LinkedIn. And I generally, it's good towards apply for a job. If I can apply directly through the company website, I'll do that instead. But using my network has really been critical and built it up over many years. And every time I have gotten to actually talk to somebody, it has been as a result of a referral from somebody I knew. So I can't even remember how I did this before, because pretty much you needed a recruiter to know what the jobs were that were out there, unless you were looking in the Globe or something crazy like that, or it seems crazy now, but there's so many resources out there to help in the job search that just didn't exist 10, 15, 20 years ago.
So I understand that you also got a chance to do some travel during COVID, which has been a little dicey, but there's some rewards for doing so.
Yeah, this all really came to a head back in March, which seems like a lifetime ago at this point. My wife's family lives out in California, Menlo Park, so in the San Francisco Peninsula. It's about halfway between San Francisco and San Jose, near Stanford. And they come to visit us regularly, and we go out to visit them once or twice a year. Never miss a birthday. And it's awesome. And the grandkids love spending time out there, love spending time with them. They're both in their 80s. My wife's brother lives out there in Mill Valley, just north of the Golden Gate Bridge, with his family. So you've got a couple of cousins that they love spending time with as well. So, you know, there are lots of reasons where we really wanted to get out there. But we were a little concerned about about COVID and traveling right now and everything. And we spent so much time talking about it for several months, really. And I think at some point I just said, look, I'm so sick of talking about this. If we're going to do it, let's just do it. And we were both on both sides of it. It wasn't like I was saying, no, we shouldn't go. My office was like, no, sometimes it was one of us and sometimes it was the other one. And okay, the dam just broke at that point. Okay, let's just do it. Let's figure it out. JetBlue has a great flight there. They guarantee the middle seat's going to be empty. So that helped me feel a little more confident. Not a lot of people are traveling. We got to the airport. It was a ghost town. There were more TSA people floating around than there were actual travelers.
How much was a JetBlue round trip to California at that time?
It had not changed much in price.
It's still like $600-700.
Yeah, it was back in June. It was less than that, or $5,500, maybe something. So it wasn't bad. I mean, they were discounting it, but they were really trying to do everything that they could to. By the time we were done and we got on the plane itself was empty. The four of us were like half the people on the plane, if you don't count the staff. Everything was cleaned and we were probably safer flying out there. And in San Jose, which is an enormous airport, it was just as empty as Logan was when we arrived. Returning about a month later, there was a few more people traveling, but it was still pretty spread out. And it was funny, there was this woman on my flight back because I flew back a week early because our dog was in a kennel and it had been 3 weeks. We're like, oh, we can't leave her in a kennel for more than that. So I came back and I needed to get back on a job search, got seated next to this woman with the middle seat empty. So we were chatting a bit and then she pulls out one of those canisters of Clorox wipes and starts wiping down her seat. And she's like, you know, at the beginning of this whole thing, I do this and I felt like people would just be looking at me thinking I was kind of weird. You know, well, they do clean them for us. Like, yeah. So I don't feel that anymore because everybody looks now and they're like, can I borrow one?
Ooh, you have Clorox wipes?
Yeah. So she's like, would you like one? I'm like, yeah, sure. Why not? I'm sure they clean this thing down, but a double clean, yeah, why not? Makes me feel more secure about it, I suppose. And it was fine. And we got tested when we got there because we absolutely did not want to get my in-laws sick or anybody else for that matter. I figured out a place where we could get tested. And Thankfully, there wasn't like the dipstick version of the test where they have this 2 foot long swab that they stick down your sinuses. I had more of a Q-tip size one, which was just fine with all of us. And a few days later, it came back negative and we were off and cooking, but we were able to stay at my brother's place for a few days and they were off camping, getting chased by bears. We had their nice house on a hillside up in Mill Valley. So that worked out pretty well to cloister away for a while.
My dad told me never to talk to strangers or to recruiters or to strange recruiters.
It's so exciting when the website gives zero information about the job I am applying for.
You take 1 3-month sabbatical and all of a sudden, you're unhireable.
You're not allowed to say it, but you're looking for someone younger than me. Joke's on you, I'm 11 years old.
Finding your next consulting gig should not be this difficult. Quite frankly, you deserve better. Syrinx is the consulting company founded and run by software consultants. We get you. Find out why our employees are some of the happiest and best paid consultants in the industry at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com. Find a better way today. Syrinx Consulting is a proud sponsor of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry.
Well, before all of this craziness, you had done some travel to Europe as well. You went to the Herculaneum, I think it's pronounced.
Herculaneum, yeah. So Herculaneum is the place that people think of mostly is
Pompeii.
Pompeii, yeah. Pompeii is enormous, as we went there as well. It was my father-in-law's 80th birthday, and they rented this place. We traveled frugally, but in this particular circumstance, because it was an 80th birthday, we decided to splurge a bit. So we had this house. It was a villa that was on a cliff on the Amalfi Coast, overlooking the ocean. And it was gorgeous. I mean, the Amalfi Coast was fabulous. And it was close to Herculaneum and Pompeii. And, you know, we could look out and see Vesuvius off in the distance. So we one day took a trip out to Herculaneum. And it's much smaller. It's like maybe 4 city blocks or something like that. And we're walking around. We'd driven in there. It was in the middle of a city. And it was interesting to find it in the first place. But it was absolutely gorgeous. You know, all these old buildings they'd been uncovering over recent years, getting all the ash from Vesuvius off. And it was a great exploration. At some point, the sky starts to cloud over, and suddenly it starts to hail and rain. And around here, you get hail, and it like hails for like a minute, and you get like a little bit of stuff on the ground that looks like something like hard snow or sleet. It looks like sleet. This was not that.
Like golf balls?
This is like tiny ice cube. Yeah, it was a little smaller than that, but it piled up.
Yeah.
And there was rain with it as well. And suddenly the old sewer ducts in the street, because, you know, sewer just ran down the street in like little culverts. Water is flushing down the streets. Wind is blowing and it's hailing like nuts. And so we find a building that still has a roof and go in under shelter. And there's some other people with us and we're just waiting and just watching all this stuff. And if you could only imagine, other than the part where you survive at the end of it, that it must have felt a little bit what it was like people in Herculaneum experiencing Vesuvius on a much lesser scale. But when it was all over, we were walking out and they were basically closed the place at that point because they were concerned about damage to the structures and it might be unsafe. So we were still there. We wandered around, kind of finished our tour, but they were moving people towards the exits and they weren't letting anybody else in. We got to the exit in the tourist building where we had first come in, it was a small museum. A tree had collapsed over the whole thing, enormous tree, and just crushed it. And as we were driving out, we said, oh, there's this pizza place we should visit on the way back. And I'll get pizza for lunch afterwards. Well, it was destroyed too. Top had been blown off. So it was really crazy. And they call it a bomba d'acqua. It's a water bomb. Yeah. So it kind of added a little bit of drama to the whole experience, but it was a beautiful, beautiful place.
Yeah, I think you'd mentioned you'd been to France as well, even back when you could actually walk up to the Mona Lisa.
Yeah, right after college, I had 2 trips I wanted to do. One was to go to Europe, get a Euro pass and a backpack and travel through Europe. And the other one was to drive cross country. So I ended up doing both. But the first one I did was Europe with the Euro pass. And I went by myself and I stayed in pensions and foyers, which are like kind of upscale hostels where there's 3 or 4 people to a room instead of 30. It was a lot of fun. Met a lot of people along the way. I had not been to Europe up until that point. So it was in England and France and Germany and Switzerland and Rome and Italy. But yeah, Paris was amazing. I mean, it's always an amazing place, still an amazing place, but it was not as touristed as it is in recent years. And you used to be able to, before they built the pyramid outside of the Louvre, you could just walk in. I don't even think you had to pay to walk in, if I remember correctly. I walked in a side door and I went around a corner and there's a Mona Lisa on a wall. You know, you could just walk right up to it, look at it. Nobody is beating you over the head with a selfie stick or anything else. It was there. It was fabulous. Flash forward about 30 years, maybe. We went there with my in-laws and my sons. And now there's the pyramid and you got to go down. You go through piles of security to get into the place. There's hordes of people. And you get into this room. Now they have a room that's basically dedicated to the Mona Lisa. And there's this wall that they've built that it's on all by itself. And you walk into the room and it's hordes of people. And you have to kind of work your way slowly. And it was one of those places where they allowed selfie sticks. So everybody had one and they're smacking each other with them and everything else. So we're waiting patiently. And at some point, my wife and I realize my son Liam is gone. At this point, he was 4 and completely disappeared. And so we are immediately going to panic mode. It's like, oh my God, we're in a foreign country. So we ran outside the room. We're looking around and this room was crowded and you leave where the main things that people go to see at Louvre, you know, like Winged Victory and Venus de Milo and this, and they're empty. And so he's nowhere in sight and you could go in every different direction and we couldn't find him. And we went back in and we're just circling around and eventually he pops up. He ended up with my in-laws. And I'm like, Liam, where were you? He's like, I was up there looking at the Mona Lisa. He just slowly worked his way up through the crowd. At this point, he's like 3 feet tall or something and got up to the front and was enjoying it and just saying, oh, this is great. And I'm looking at it and everybody else is taller than him. So he got to stay and just look at it for a while. And then eventually he worked his way back out, but it was so crowded, we couldn't see him. We just panicked.
Oh, that's the worst feeling as a parent. Yeah. Where's my kid?
Yeah, and he's known for that. He would just see something and he'd just veer off. He'd like turn around, where'd Liam go? It's great because he is such an inquisitive kid. And this is a parent seeing this and where they sort of veer off from what you know and what you've done is really when the best part of it is because they're becoming their own person. It's not just a reflection of yourself. And he's like that.
You had also traveled to Scotland to try some scotch straight from the source.
Scotland was fun. The start of that trip, it was my birthday, special birthday year. So I got a couple trips out of it. One was to Scotland and then the other one was to Nova Scotia. But on the Scotland trip, we actually signed up for a Rick Steves tour. We went with my stepmother and that was awesome. First of all, it was a great tour. Yeah, promote Rick Steves for 2 seconds. Our kids went with us, but they were far younger than anybody else on the trip. You know, it was kind of retired educators mostly and nearer retirement than certainly than they were. But they really adopted our kids and it was a fun trip. But we started in Edinburgh and I got there a couple days before the rest of the family because they were doing something else and they met me there. Actually, I was in Sri Lanka and I come home and then I went to Edinburgh. And so we met there. My couple of days, the first thing I did was I signed myself up for this literary pub tour where they talked about Robert Burns and Robert Louis Stevenson and Sir Walter Scott and all the places they used to hang out to drink and poetry and everything. And it was very cool. But we went to several pubs. And, you know, they would just have walls lined with scotches. And I have to admit, I'm not an expert on scotch, but I do enjoy it. To me, and this really came out of this trip is, and it's like with food too, it's the memory that it induces for me. So I will drink scotch from the places that I visited in Scotland just to remember that experience. Like Oban was one of the places we went to because we went to the Isle of Mull and the Isle of Iona where they tell at this time was where the Book of Kells was originally being written. It's not clear whether the entire thing was written there or was just part of there. And it was secured there for a while the Vikings were doing their thing. But Iona was so beautiful and it was on the coast and tried their scotch amongst others. Next day, took a tour of the Mull. I never realized how rural Scotland is. I mean, I knew kind of it's a pretty rural place. It's really a rural place. So it's just beautiful, gorgeous scenery and hills and valleys and Loch Ness and
the coastline.
It's like Maine in a way where it's just very jaggedy coastline and rocky and lots of little islands all over the place. And, you know, we got to Mull and took the tour on the little bus we had. And it was like a one-lane road. It was literally a one-lane road, not like one lane in each direction. It was just one lane. Somebody would come from the other direction, which was pretty rare. And one of you had to pull over. Yeah, we make it across Mull and then we get to Iona and take another ferry to Iona. So it was a couple of ferries. And it was a tiny little island in this abbey, you know, small population. the feeling of it is you're out of time. And they had lunch there and they didn't have scotch.
Did the Scottish folks and the Scottish bartenders add a splash of water all the time?
Yeah, that was an option. And I did do the branch water. Well, the joke was we were doing this tour. It was overcast and a little bit rainy. And we would take our drinks outside because, you know, it was a small group of us. So we'd usually just go stand outside so the tour leader could talk and tell the story of the area. And so it started raining and I'm standing under a tree. And the tree is like dripping water into my glass. I'm like, oh, real branch water. Tasted pretty good.
So then you've been to New Scotland, Nova Scotia as well.
Yeah, we went to Nova Scotia. We did a driving tour. We drove up the coast of Maine, stops along the way. You know, but the main goal for me, at least, was to get to Cape Breton. I really wanted to see the Cadian culture there and the music. The whole trip was fantastic, but that tour around in the Cabot Trail basically goes around the outer edge of Cape Breton. And we stayed in a variety of places and listening to music along the way, mostly for me, and everybody else was like, okay, Brian wants to go listen to music again. But it was a great experience, I think, for everybody. But we stayed at this one place, and it was Canadian Independence Day, which was July 6th. And there were these cottages that were on this hillside overlooking the ocean. And they had a lobster boil there, and, you know, lobster and clams and corn and the whole thing and potato salad and everything. So just having the celebration for Canadian Independence Day. And then they were going to have fireworks, and we're like, oh, this will be cool. And it was so neat because as dusk rolled around, everybody from town drove up the hill to this inn and like parked along the cliff. And not a huge population, you know, but it was still a fair number of people. And they just brought out these boxes of fireworks and, you know, lit them off over the ocean. And when it was all over, everybody just piled into their cars and then drove back down the hill again. And it was really neat. It was just a beautiful spot. And it was just neat in sort of its ordinariness. It wasn't overly produced or anything else. It was just cool.
Right on. So I know as Disney Plus came out with Hamilton a few months back, and many folks, including many kids, my middle daughter Julia included, absolutely loved the musical, have been singing it nonstop, and I've learned more about that founding father through that than I had before. But you've actually read the book by Chernow, right?
Yeah, it's a great book. History is my avocation, my passion. The challenge I have with history is I'm terrible at remembering dates and names, which made it difficult in school. But I love reading history. I mean, history is like a great story. When done well, is a great story that's true. And Chernow is an awesome writer. And Alexander Hamilton's life, it's an opera. I mean, where he started on the island of Nevis in the Caribbean to becoming the first Secretary of Treasury is phenomenal. I mean, this is like the vision that America has of itself. It's like anybody can rise to anywhere that they set their goals to. And he brings the whole thing alive through that moving to the U.S. and moving to New York. And then involvement in the Revolutionary War and working for George Washington and then coming into his government and basically building the beginnings of the financial system that we still rely on today is incredible. This guy.
Incredibly prolific writer, too.
He's one of these people that couldn't possibly have ever slept. Yes. There was so much crammed into his life. But the play came out, and the first time I had any awareness of it at all was at this talent show at an elementary school. Going back to that, one of the girls dressed up in Revolutionary Garb and sang that song. And I'm like, oh, what's that song? What's that from? And my kids enlightened me to Hamilton. And, you know, I started to hear a couple of the songs, like, okay. And then we bought the cast album and listened to that. And very quickly, it grew on me and, like, realized the breadth and the depth of that music. And, you know, it wasn't just hip hop. He was pulling from all sorts of musical standards, and the words, the language, everything he was doing was incredible. So we listened to that obsessively for at least a year. I don't think there was a day that went by when if I was driving someplace, I wasn't playing it and the kids were listening to it and we were all having a great time. And then we would go to New York. We tried to go maybe once a year. We'd go see a play or do something. We'd try to get tickets to it, and they were hideously expensive. You know, be in the rafters for $600. And we're like, I can't do that. If you could even get tickets. And so they came to Boston and we signed up to get tickets when it came to Boston, the Opera House. And first my wife and I went with some friends of ours and you know, it was a great show. Obviously, we really, really enjoyed it. And then we started to feel guilty because our kids were like, once they introduced it to us, we want to go. Like, So we finally sucked it up and we bought two tickets for them. This is like the first time they'd ever just in Boston, and we're just going to let them loose in a theater and hope they find their seats and all the rest of this. You know, they're 13 and 16 now, and this was a couple of years ago. So I was like, Daniel, you will not lose your brother. You will not let him walk off. You will stay attached to the hip through the entire thing.
Don't let him wander to the Mona Lisa.
Yeah, here's the tickets. You know, we've shown you the map where your seats are approximately. So you show them and somebody will show you where your seats are. And don't be noisy. And, you know, and then we went next door and had dinner and drinks and waited for the show to be over. And they came out and they were just beaming from ear to ear and they had a great time. And it was a lot of fun. I do want to say one thing is that if you ever get the chance, there's a video of David Diggs, who plays Thomas Jefferson, who speaks at Brown University at a graduation. And if you ever wondered just how brilliant this guy is, just go and listen to that. Most of us have forgotten, you know, who spoke at our graduation, have no idea what they spoke about or anything else. It was not memorable. This guy's speech was just memorable and beautifully done and live. He's an incredible character.
Well, we will be publishing in the show notes for this episode a bunch of links. We'll definitely have to get one to that David Diggs commencement speech at Brown. And we'll also cover a bunch of other topics. So if you want to check out the show notes, you can at underserved.fm. That's underserved.fm, like radio, where you can find this episode and all of our previous episodes from seasons 1 and 2. Now, I understand that you also have an author in your family as well, right?
Yes, my wife's brother, Jamie Workman, he wrote a book a few years back called Heart of Dryness, which is about challenges of water resources and the drying climate, drying up of water reservoirs, and dealing with these challenges and what kind of solutions are available. And so as part of his early research, he moved to South Africa for several years and ended up making a trip to visit the Sand People, First Peoples in Botswana, which required him to travel through the Kalahari Desert. And so he had in his mind packing up his Land Rover, which he had christened Rosinante from Don Quixote, which probably at the time didn't realize how literal that was going to be, and took a bunch of water and food and set off to meet them. Partway through his journey, well into the desert, he broke down in a place where not many people pass through. Couldn't get the car started again. Dirt and sand had gotten into the air intake and it just wasn't going anywhere. Wasn't sure what was wrong with it. Ended up sleeping on top of it because there was a lot of wild animals around. Had no problem having a nice dinner at his expense. So he was pretty much stuck on top of his roof throughout the night. He was quite fortunate that the next day, another group happened to pass through and that they were able to get his Land Rover going again. And so he eventually made his way there and sort of humbled a bit, realizing that maybe they're not the one that needed help as much as he did because they were able to survive quite well in a land of very little water. So part of that experience was for him was learning from them how they deal with water is a very limited resource. How do you share it? Who owns the rights to it? Who gets how much? All those kinds of things. Because they didn't bring water to them, they went to the water, wherever it might be. And so they had a very practical method to that that involved there being a value to water. And they used that, so it was part of their commerce. So he's been working on a project since then, as well as writing the book. And it's a thesis kind of a book. So there's a lot about water and how it affects relationships between nations. You know, if I've got water that first passes through my country, then into your country, that seems like it's an opportunity for a lot of tension to be created. How do people deal with that? And so he talks about that in the book. And there's a lot of these kinds of stories that break down and are pretty interesting and fun. But he's been trying to evolve that into what could we do in this country and in the developed world that would be analogous to what the Sun people are doing, and started his own company. They're still working on, and they've done some trial work in both Sonoma and in Morocco to basically have everybody get a share of their water. And they can either use it all or they can make it available for other people to consume, in which case they get discounts and so there's value to two people, but it's voluntary. It's like you can use your water, you can use more water, and you'll pay for the more water and you'll have to get it from somebody else, and building up a digital system framework to support that. And they're continuing to do pilots like that and promote it. But it's a pretty neat idea, and particularly in California where they're from. Everybody's been reading the stories about the drought that they've been through in the last several years and now the fires they've been experiencing for really several years now as well and climaxing in this year. that it's a real concern. It's a neat effort that he's been involved in.
So I know that you and I are both podcast fans, but it turns out you are not the first member of your household to appear on a podcast.
Yes, my wife, Becky, or Rebecca, was invited to do a podcast with Andrea Koppel, Ted Koppel's daughter. She had been introduced to Andrea through one of her colleagues. She works at Wellesley College in Wellesley as a career advisor. And so Andrea had asked her if she would like to do a podcast. So the podcast is mostly for young adults that are just graduating from college or in college and trying to figure out, A, what they want to do for a career, what's available to them, what it's like to do that kind of job, and how do you get yourself involved in it? What kind of tracks are available? So she interviews lots of different people that are doing those jobs and been in those careers for some period of time. And she has a website with a lot of great information for young adults to help make that leap. And, you know, like I said at the very beginning, for me, it was like, well, what's my dad doing? Computers, like, you know, well, I can try that and see if that works for me. If it doesn't, I know I don't want to schlep around insulation. So what are my other choices? Well, she's created this repository of here's all sorts of different kinds of careers, run the gamut, and people who have actually done them and can talk to them and those experiences. So she brought my wife in as somebody who also works with recent graduates mostly right now, but you know, also in the past has worked with students who are still going through college and helping them think about their careers and what the resources are available to them and how to move forward and how to work on your resume and how to present yourself and what are the things you want to talk about when you interview for a position. And that was what they discussed as part of that podcast. It was really neat. And she enjoyed working with Andrea tremendously. So she's very authentic and inquisitive and really was a lot of fun to just have the opportunity to speak with. And she's very passionate about what she's doing.
All right, Brian. Well, thank you very much for coming down today and sharing all of your stories with us here on Underserved.
Thanks, Andrea. It's been great. I really enjoyed the time here. It's been nice to get out and a lot of fun.
Yeah, any time out of the house these days is a bonus. And we'll talk to everyone very soon on the next episode of Underserved.